Chapter 9. Finding Words. They were making hay in the Lord's long meadow, strung out across the slope in the bright shadows of morning. Three of the mowers were women, and of the two men, one was a boy, as Tenar could make out from some distance, and the other was stooped and grizzled. She came up along the mown rows and asked one of the women about the man with the leather cap.
"Him from down by Falmouth, said the mower. "Don't know where he's got to."
The others came along the row, glad of a break. None of them knew where the man from Middle Valley was or why he wasn't mowing with them.
"That kind don't stay," the grizzled man said. "Shiftless. You know him, missus?"
"Not by choice," said Tanar. "He came lurking about my place, frightened the child. I don't know what he's called, even."
"Calls himself Handy," the boy volunteered.
The others looked at her or looked away and said nothing. They were beginning to piece out who she must be, the Cargish woman in the old major's house. They were tenants of the Lord of Ray Albi, suspicious of the villagers, leery of anything to do with Ogion. They wetted their scythes, turned away, strung out again, fell to work. Tanar walked down from the hillside field, past a row of walnut trees, to the road. On it, a man stood waiting. Her heart leapt. She strode on to meet him. It was Aspen, the wizard of the mansion house. He stood gracefully leaning on his tall pine staff in the shade of a roadside tree. As she came out onto the road, he said,
"Are you looking for work?"
"No."
"My lord needs field hands. This hot weather's on the turn. The hay must be got in."
To Gohar, Flint's widow, what he said was appropriate, and Gohar answered him politely. "No doubt your skill can turn the rain from the fields till the hay's in." But he knew she was the woman to whom Ogion, dying, had spoken his true name, and given that knowledge, what he said was so insulting and deliberately false as to serve as a clear warning. She had been about to ask him if he knew where the man Handy was. Instead, she said, "I came to say to the overseer here that a man he took on for the haymaking left my village as a thief and worse. Not one he'd choose to have about the place, but it seems the man's moved on." She gazed calmly at Aspen until he answered with an effort,
"I know nothing about these people."
She had thought him on the morning of Ogion's death to be a young man, a tall, handsome youth with a grey cloak and a silvery staff. He did not look as young as she had thought him. Or he was young, but somehow dried and withered. His stare and his voice were now openly contemptuous, and she answered him in Gohar's voice, "To be sure, I beg your pardon." She wanted no trouble with him. She made to go on her way back to the village, but Aspen said,
"Wait!"
She waited.
"A thief and worse, you say? But slander's cheap, and a woman's tongue worse than any thief. You come up here to make bad blood among the field hands, casting calumny and lies, the dragon seed every witch sows behind her. Did you think I did not know you for a witch? When I saw that foul imp that clings to you, do you think I did not know how it was begotten and for what purposes? The man did well who tried to destroy that creature, but the job should be completed. You defied me once, across the body of the old wizard, and I forbore to punish you then, for his sake and in the presence of others. But now you've come too far, and I warn you, woman, I will not have you set foot on this domain. And if you cross my will or dare so much as speak to me again, I will have you driven from Ray Albi and off the Overfell with the dogs at your heels. Have you understood me?" No, Tanar said. I have never understood men like you.
She turned and set off down the road. Something like a stroking touch went up her spine, and her hair lifted up on her head. She turned sharp round to see the wizard reach out his staff toward her, and the dark lightnings gather round it, and his lips part to speak. She thought in that moment, because Ged has lost his majory, I thought all men had, but I was wrong. And a civil voice said, well, well, what have we here? Two of the men from Havnar had come out onto the road from the cherry orchards on the other side of it. They looked from Aspen to Tenar with bland and courtly expressions, as if regretting the necessity of preventing a wizard from laying a curse on a middle-aged widow. But really, really, it would not do. Mistress Goha, said the man with the gold-embroidered shirt and bowed to her. The other, the bright-eyed one, saluted her also, smiling. Mistress Goha, he said, is one who, like the king, bears her true name openly, I think, and unafraid. Living in Gaunt, she may prefer that we use her Gauntish name, but knowing her deeds, I ask to do her honour, for she wore the ring that no woman wore since Elf Aran. He dropped to one knee as if it were the most natural thing in the world, took Tenar's right hand very lightly and quickly and touched his forehead to her wrist. He released her and stood up, smiling that kind, collusive smile. Ah, said Tenar, flustered and warmed right through. There's all kinds of power in the world. Thank you. The wizard stood motionless, staring. He had closed his mouth on the curse and drawn back his staff, but there was still a visible darkness about it and about his eyes. She did not know whether he had known or had just now learned that she was Tenar of the Ring. It didn't matter. He could not hate her more. To be a woman was her fault. Nothing could worsen or amend it, in his eyes. No punishment was enough. He had looked at what had been done to Tharoo and approved. Sir, she said now to the older man, anything less than honesty and openness seems dishonored to the king for whom you speak, and act as now. I'd like to honour the king and his messengers, but my own honour lies in silence until my friend releases me. I'm sure, my lords, that he'll send some word to you in time. Only give him time, I pray you.
Surely, said the one, and the other,
as much time as he wants, and your trust, my lady, honours us above all.
She went on down the road to Rhea Albi at last, shaken by the shock and change of things. The wizard's flaying hatred, her own angry contempt, her terror at the sudden knowledge of his will and power to do her harm, the sudden end of that terror in the refuge offered by the envoys of the king, the men who had come in the white-sailed ship from the haven itself, the Tower of the Sword and the Throne, the centre of right and order. Her heart lifted up in gratitude. There was indeed a king upon that throne, and in his crown the chiefest jewel would be the rune of peace. She liked the younger man's face, clever and kindly, and the way he had knelt to her as to a queen, and his smile that had a wink hidden in it. She turned to look back. The two envoys were walking up the road to the mansion house with the wizard Aspen. They seemed to be conversing with him amicably, as if nothing had happened. That sank her surge of hopeful trust a bit. To be sure, they were courtiers. It wasn't their business to quarrel or to judge and disapprove. And he was a wizard, and their host's wizard. Still, she thought, they needn't have walked and talked with him quite so comfortably.
The men from Havna stayed several days with the Lord of Realbi, perhaps hoping that the Archmage would change his mind and come to them, but they did not seek him, nor press Tanar about where he might be. When they left at last, Tanar told herself that she must make up her mind what to do. There was no real reason for her to stay here, and two strong reasons for leaving, Aspen and Handy, neither of whom could she trust to let her and Thoreau alone. Yet she found it hard to make up her mind, because it was hard to think of going. In leaving Realbi now, she left Ogion, lost him as she had not lost him, while she kept his house and weeded his onions. And she thought, I will never dream of the sky down there. Here, where Carlesen had come, she was Tenar, she thought. Down in Middle Valley, she would only be Gohar again. She delayed. She said to herself, am I to fear those scoundrels? To run from them? That's what they want me to do. Are they to make me come and go at their will? She said to herself, I'll just finish the cheese-making. She kept Thoreau always with her, and the days went by. Moss came with a tale to tell. Tanar had asked her about the wizard Aspen, not telling her the whole story, but saying that he had threatened her, which in fact might well be all he had meant to do. Moss usually kept clear of the old lord's domain, but she was curious about what went on there, and not unwilling to find the chance to chat with some acquaintances there, a woman from whom she had learned midwifery, and others whom she had attended as healer or finder. She got them talking about the doings at the mansion house. They all hated Aspen, and so were quite ready to talk about him. But their tales must be heard as half spite and fear. Still, there would be facts among the fancies. Moss herself attested that until Aspen came 3 years ago, the younger lord, the grandson, had been fit and well, though a shy, sullen man, scared-like, she said. Then, about the time the young lord's mother died, the old lord had sent to Roke for a wizard.
What for? With Lord Ogion not a mile away, and they're all witch-folk themselves in the mansion.
But Aspen had come. He had paid his respects, and no more to Ogion, and always, Moss said, stayed up at the mansion. Since then, less and less had been seen of the grandson, and it was said now that he lay day and night in bed.
Like a sick baby, all shriveled up, said one of the women who had been into the house on some errand. But the old lord, 100 years old or near or more, Moss insisted. She had no fear of numbers and no respect for them. The old lord was flourishing. Full of juice, they said. And one of the men, for they would have only men wait on them in the mansion, had told one of the women that the old lord had hired the wizard to make him live forever, and that the wizard was doing that, feeding him, the man said, off the grandson's life. And the man saw no harm in it, saying, who wouldn't want to live forever?
Well, Tanar said, taken aback, that's an ugly story. Don't they talk about all this in the village? Moss shrugged. It was a matter of let be again. The doings of the powerful were not to be judged by the powerless. And there was the dim, blind loyalty, the rootedness in place. The old man was their lord, Lord of Realbi. Nobody else's business what he did. Moss evidently felt this herself.
Risky, she said. Bound to go wrong, such a trick.
But she did not say it was wicked. No sign of the man Handy had been seen up at the mansion. Longing to be sure that he had left the Overfell, Tanar asked an acquaintance or two in the village if they had seen such a man, but she got unwilling and equivocal replies. They wanted no part of her affairs.
Let be.
Only old Fan treated her as a friend and fellow villager, and that might be because his eyes were so dim he could not clearly see Theroux. She took the child with her now when she went into the village, or any distance at all from the house. Theroux did not find this bondage wearisome. She stayed close by 10 hours as a much younger child would do, working with her or playing. Her play was with cat's cradle, basket-making, and with a couple of bone figures that Thénard had found in a little grass bag on one of Ogian's shelves. There was an animal that might be a dog or a sheep, a figure that might be a woman or a man. To Thénard they had no sense of power or danger about them, and Moss said, "Just toys." To Theroux, they were a great magic. She moved them about in the patterns of some silent story for hours at a time. She did not speak as she played. Sometimes she built houses for the person and the animal, stone cairns, huts of mud and straw. They were always in her pocket in their grass bag. She was learning to spin. She could hold the distaff in the burned hand and twist the drop spindle with the other. They had combed the goats regularly since they had been there, and by now had a good sackful of silky goat hair to be spun. "But I should be teaching her," Thénard thought, distressed. "Teach her all," Ogian said. "And what am I teaching her? Cooking and spinning?" Then another part of her mind said in Gohar's voice, "And are those not true arts, needful and noble? Is wisdom all words?" Still she worried over the matter, and one afternoon, while Theroux was pulling the goat hair to clean and loosen it, and she was carding it, in the shade of the peach tree, she said, "Theroux, maybe it's time you began to learn the true names of things. There is a language in which all things bear their true names, and deed and word are one. By speaking that tongue, Segoy raised the islands from the deeps. It is the language dragons speak." The child listened, silent. Thénard laid down her carding combs and picked up a small stone from the ground. "In that tongue," she said, "this is Tolk." Theroux watched what she did and repeated the word Tolk, but without voice, only forming it with her lips, which were drawn back a little on the right side by the scarring. The stone lay on Thénard's palm, a stone. They were both silent. "Not yet," Thénard said. "That's not what I have to teach you now." She let the stone fall to the ground and picked up her combs and a handful of cloudy grey wool Theroux had prepared for carding. "Maybe when you have your true name, maybe that will be the time, not now. Now, listen. Now is the time for stories, for you to begin to learn the stories. I can tell you stories of the archipelago and of the Kargad lands. I told you a story I learned from my friend Ihal the Silent. Now I'll tell you one I learned from my friend Lark when she told it to her children and mine. This is the story of Arndawa and Arvard. As long ago as forever, as far away as Celador, there lived a man called Arndawa, a woodcutter who went up in the hills alone. One day, deep in the forest, he cut a great oak tree down. As it fell, it cried out to him in a human voice. It was a pleasant afternoon for them both. But that night, as she lay by the sleeping child, Thénard could not sleep. She was restless, concerned with one petty anxiety after another. Did I fasten the pasture gate? Does my hand ache from carding, or is it arthritis beginning? And so on. Then she became very uneasy thinking she heard noises outside the house. Why haven't I got me a dog, she thought. Stupid not to have a dog. A woman and child living alone ought to have a dog these days. But this is Ogion's house. Nobody would come here to do evil. But Ogion is dead. Dead. Buried at the roots of the tree at the forest's edge. And no one will come. Sparrowhawk's gone. Run away. Not even Sparrowhawk anymore. A shadow man. No good to anyone. A dead man forced to be alive. And I have no strength. There's no good in me. I say the word of the making and it dies in my mouth. It is meaningless. A stone. I am a woman, an old woman, weak, stupid. All I do is wrong. All I touch turns to ashes, shadow, stone. I am the creature of darkness, swollen with darkness. Only fire can cleanse me. Only fire can eat me. Eat me away like... She sat up and cried out aloud in her own language. The curse be turned and turn, and brought her right arm out and down, pointing straight to the closed door. Then, leaping out of bed, she went to the door, flung it open, and said into the cloudy night, You come too late, Aspen. I was eaten long ago. Go clean your own house. There was no answer, no sound, but a faint, sour, vile smell of burning, singed cloth or hair. She shut the door, set Ogion's staff against it, and looked to see that Tharu still slept. She did not sleep herself that night. In the morning, she took Tharu into the village to ask Fan if he would want the yarn they had been spinning. It was an excuse to get away from the house and to be for a little while among people. The old man said he would be glad to weave the yarn, and they talked for a few minutes under the great painted fan, while the apprentice scowled and clacked away grimly at the loom. As Tenar and Tharu left Fran's house, somebody dodged around the corner of the little cottage where she had lived. Something, wasps or bees, was stinging Tenar's neck and head, and there was a patch of rain all round. A thunder shower, but there were no clouds. Stones. She saw the pebbles strike the ground. Tharu had stopped, startled and puzzled, looking around. A couple of boys ran from behind the cottage, half hiding, half showing themselves, calling out to each other, laughing. Come along, Tenar said steadily, and they walked to Ogion's house. Tenar was shaking, and the shaking got worse as they walked. She tried to conceal it from Tharu, who looked troubled but not frightened, not having understood what had happened. As soon as they entered the house, Tenar knew someone had been there while they were in the village. It smelled of burned meat and hair. The coverlet of their bed had been disarranged. When she tried to think what to do, she knew there was a spell on her. It had been laid waiting for her. She could not stop shaking, and her mind was confused, slow, unable to decide. She could not think. She had said the word, the true name of the stone, and it had been flung at her, in her face, in the face of evil, the hideous face. She had dared speak. She could not speak. She thought, in her own language, I cannot think in Hardik. I must not. She could think in Kargish, not quickly. It was as if she had to ask the girl, Aha, who she had been long ago, to come out of the darkness and think for her, to help her, as she had helped her last night, turning the wizard's curse back on him. Aha had not known a great deal of what Tenar and Gohar knew, but she had known how to curse, and how to live in the dark, and how to be silent. It was hard to do that, to be silent. She wanted to cry out. She wanted to talk, to go to Moss and tell her what had happened, why she must go, to say goodbye at least. She tried to say to Heather, "The goats are yours now, Heather." And she managed to say that in Hardik, so that Heather would understand. But Heather did not understand. She stared and laughed. "Oh, they're Lord Ogion's goats," she said. "Then you," Tenar tried to say, "go on keeping them for him." But a deadly sickness came into her, and she heard her voice saying shrilly, "Fool, half-wit, imbecile, woman!" Heather stared and stopped laughing. Tenar covered her own mouth with her hand. She took Heather and turned her to look at the cheeses ripening in the milking shed and pointed to them and to Heather back and forth until Heather nodded vaguely and laughed again because she was acting so queer. Tenar nodded to Theroux, "Come," and went into the house where the foul smell was stronger, making Theroux cower. Tenar fetched out their packs and their travel shoes. In her pack she put her spare dress and shifts, Theroux's two old dresses and the half-made new one, and the spare cloth. The spindle whorls she had carved for herself and Theroux, and a little food and a clay bottle of water for the way. In Theroux's pack went Theroux's best baskets, the bone person, and the bone animal in their grass bag, some feathers, a little maize mat Moss had given her, and a bag of nuts and raisins. She wanted to say, "Go water the peach tree," but dared not. She took the child out and showed her. Theroux watered the tiny shoot carefully. They swept and straightened up the house, working fast, in silence. Tenar set a jug back on the shelf and saw on the other end of the shelf the three great books, Ogion's books. Aha saw them, and they were nothing to her, big leather boxes full of paper. But Tenar stared at them and bit her knuckle, frowning with the effort to decide, to know what to do, and to know how to carry them. She could not carry them, but she must. They could not stay here in the desecrated house, the house where hatred had come in. They were his, Ogion's, Ged's, hers, the knowledge. Teach her all. She emptied their wool and yarn from the sack she had meant to carry it in, and put the books in, one atop the other, and tied the neck of the bag with a leather strap with a loop to hold it by. Then she said, "We must go now, Theroux." She spoke in Kargish, but the child's name was the same. It was a Kargish word. Flame, flaming. And she came, asking no questions, carrying her little hoard in the pack on her back. They took up their walking sticks, the hazel shoot and the alder branch. They left Ogion's staff beside the door in the dark corner. They left the door of the house wide open to the wind from the sea. An animal sense guided Tenar away from the fields and away from the hill road she'd come by. She took a short cut down the steep falling pastures, holding Theroux's hand, to the wagon road that zigzagged down to Gaunt Port. She knew that if she met Aspen she was lost, and thought he might be waiting for her on the way, but not maybe on this way. After a mile or so of the descent, she began to be able to think. What she thought first was that she had taken the right road, for the Hardik words were coming back to her, and after a while, the true words, so that she stooped and picked up a stone and held it in her hand, saying in her mind, "Tolk," and she put that stone in her pocket. She looked out into the vast levels of air and cloud and said in her mind once, "Carlesson." And her mind cleared as that air was clear. They came into a long cutting shadowed by high grassy banks and outcrops of rock, where she was a little uneasy. As they came out onto the turn, they saw the dark blue bay below them, and coming into it between the armed cliffs, a beautiful ship under full sail. Tanar had feared the last such ship, but not this one. She wanted to run down the road to meet it. That she could not do. They went at Theroux's pace. It was a better pace than it had been 2 months ago, and going downhill made it easy too. But the ship ran to meet them. There was a mage wind in her sails. She came across the bay like a flying swan. She was in port before Tanar and Theroux were halfway down the next long turning of the road. Towns of any size at all were very strange places to Tanar. She had not lived in them. She had seen the greatest city in Earthsea, Havna, once for a while, and she had sailed into Gaunt Port with Ged years ago. But they had climbed on up the road to the Overfell without pausing in the streets. The only other town she knew was Valmouth, where her daughter lived, a sleepy, sunny little harbour town, where a ship trading from the Andrades was a great event, and most of the conversation of the inhabitants concerned dried fish. She and the child came into the streets of Gaunt Port when the sun was still well above the western sea. Theroux had walked 15 miles without complaint and without being worn out, though certainly she was very tired. Tanar was tired too, having not slept the night before and having been much distressed. And also Ogion's books had been a heavy burden. Halfway down the road, she had put them into the backpack and the food and clothing into the wool sack, which was better, but not all that much better. So they came trudging among outlying houses to the land gate of the city where the road, coming between two carved stone dragons, turned into a street. There a man, the guard of the gate, eyed them. Theroux bent her burned face down toward the shoulder and hid her burned hand under the apron of her dress.
"Will you be going to a house in town, mistress?" the guard asked, peering at the child.
Tanar did not know what to say. She did not know there were guards at city gates. She had nothing to pay a tollkeeper or an innkeeper. She did not know a soul in Gaunt Port, except, she thought now, the wizard, the one who had come up to bury Ogion. What was he called? But she did not know what he was called. She stood there with her mouth open like heather.
"Go on, go on," the guard said, bored, and turned away.
She wanted to ask him where she would find the road south across the headlands, the coast road to Valmouth, but she dared not waken his interest again, lest he decide she was, after all, a vagrant or a witch, or whatever he and the stone dragons were supposed to keep out of Gaunt Port. So they went on between the dragons. Theroux looked up a little to see them and tramped along on cobblestones, more and more amazed, bewildered, and abashed. It did not seem to Tanar that anybody or anything in the world had been kept out of Gaunt Port. It was all here. Tall houses of stone, wagons, drays, carts, cattle, donkeys, marketplaces, shops, crowds, people, people. The farther they went, the more people there were. Theroux clung to Tanar's hand, sidling, hiding her face with her hair. Tanar clung to Theroux's hand. She did not see how they could stay here, so the only thing to do was get started south and go till nightfall. All too soon now, hoping to camp in the woods. Tanar picked out a broad woman in a broad white apron who was closing the shutters of a shop and crossed the street, resolved to ask her for the road south out of the city.
The woman's firm, red face looked pleasant enough, but as Tenar was getting up her courage to speak to her, Tharu clutched her hard as if trying to hide herself against her, and looking up, she saw, coming down the street toward her, the man with the leather cap. He saw her at the same instant. He stopped. Tenar seized Tharu's arm and half-dragged, half-swung her round. "Come," she said, and strode straight on past the man. Once she had put him behind her, she walked faster, going downhill toward the flare and dark of the sunset water and the docks and quays at the foot of the steep street. Tharu ran with her, gasping as she had gasped after she was burned. Tall masts rocked against the red and yellow sky. The ship, sails furled, lay against the stone pier beyond an oared galley. Tenar looked back. The man was following them, close behind. He was not hurrying. She ran out onto the pier, but after a way, Tharu stumbled and could not go on, unable to get her breath. Tenar picked her up, and the child held to her, hiding her face in Tenar's shoulder. But Tenar could scarcely move, thus laden. Her legs shook under her. She took a step, and another, and another. She came to the little wooden bridge they had laid from the pier to the ship's deck. She laid her hand on its rail. A sailor on deck, a bald, wiry fellow, looked her over.
"What's wrong, missus?"
he said. Is the ship from Havner?"
"From the King's City, sure."
"Let me aboard."
"Well, I can't do that," the man said, grinning, but his eyes shifted. He was looking at the man who'd come to stand beside Tenar. "You don't have to run away," Handy said to her. "I don't mean you any harm. I don't want to hurt you. You don't understand. I was the one got help for her, wasn't I? I was really sorry what happened. I want to help you with her." He put out his hand, as if drawn irresistibly to touch Tharu. Tenar could not move. She had promised Tharu that he would never touch her again. She saw the hand touch the child's bare, flinching arm.
"What do you want with her?" said another voice. Another sailor had taken the place of the bald one. A young man. Tenar thought he was her son. Handy was quick to speak.
She took my kid. My niece. It's mine. She witched it. She ran off with it. See?"
She could not speak at all. The words were gone from her again, taken from her. The young sailor was not her son. His face was thin and stern, with clear eyes. Looking at him, she found the words. "Let me come aboard, please." The young man held out his hand. She took it, and he brought her across the gangway onto the deck of the ship.
"Wait there," he said to Handy, and to her,
"Come with me." But her legs would not hold her up. She sank down in a heap on the deck of the ship from Havner, dropping the heavy sack, but clinging to the child.
"Don't let him take her. Oh, don't let them have her. Not again. Not again. Not again."